Welcome to the Reboot Republic podcast, a podcast that goes behind headlines and looks at the big issues in this republic of inequality. We are the podcast of solutions and the podcast of hope, and I'm your host, Rory Hearn, and I'm absolutely delighted today to be joined by two of our leading economists and social analysts in this country, Ciarán Nugent from the Nevin Economic Research Institute, economist there, and Colette Bennett, economic and social policy researcher with Social Justice Ireland. Colette and Ciarán, I'm delighted to have you back on Reboot Republic. It's been a while.
It has. Delighted to be here, Rory. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Rory.
Ciarán, now, as always, we'll struggle to get a few words out of Ciarán. That was probably the most he'll put together.
I just worry when it comes, talking over with the Zoom, you know, comes in and out. That's all.
I know the Zoom is awful, but when it comes, it's worth listening to. Listen, in terms of the context of today, we're, you know, in part why we haven't been talking, obviously housing has been a key thing, and you know, I know both of you have been looking at that. But in terms of the wider, you know, crisis over the pandemic, you know, these discussions of economics and inequality have understandably taken a back seat. But now we're in this entering post-pandemic phase, obviously within reason, and Delta and all those issues that have to be worked on still. But in terms of the economics, it's been an interesting time, I think, when we look at, and both of you, if I'm correct, attended the National Economic Dialogue over the last couple of days, which is where the government sets it out to the unions and community groups and business, how they are going to do the economic, where the policy's at, and there's some discussion. It'll be interesting to hear. But my sense of looking at it, and maybe both of you could respond to this, is that we had obviously this unprecedented expenditure during the pandemic and response, and some of it quite progressive and positive. Spending on welfare and, you know, the PUP payments and supports going beyond traditional welfare. And globally, if we look at it globally, we saw states respond, and in a sense, in a way, the decline of neoliberalism and austerity and the approach of stimulus and the approach of the state coming back in and borrowing. And we're seeing the kind of growing consensus internationally that states now need to borrow, countries need to borrow to invest. And yet it seems straight away we're back in this country to the conservative dinosaurs of austerity, and we have to cut back spending. And it's like they missed the memo. Things have changed. The world has changed. And we need to invest and build housing and invest in environmental technology and the transition. What was your sense of where do you think our government's economic policy is at and thinking in that context? Maybe Colette, do you want to go first?
Sure. I'll take my ladies first pitch. In terms of, you know, the decline of neoliberalism, I actually wrote that down and underlined the word decline, just because I think it was more dormancy when it comes to Ireland as opposed to actual decline.
Yeah.
You know, we did what we had to do within the context, but we tried to do it in as short a time as possible. And very, very quickly, we got back to the, you know, we have debts to repay, as if this was somehow a house mortgage. Rather than, you know, the debt of a country to try and sustain activity and social infrastructure and all of those things. To be fair, I thought it was quite interesting at the National Economic Dialogue that there was this openness in talking about budgets and finances to at least talk about social infrastructure in the same vein.
I'm going to pause the podcast there for a minute and ask you to help me and help Reboot Republic. I've recorded nearly 300 episodes of this podcast, and it has helped shape many of the conversations around the social change that this country needs on inequality, on housing, on the environment, on poverty, and on health. But while the podcast is free, it absolutely has value. So I'm asking you to go to patreon.com/tortoiseshack to see if there's a tier that you would be happy to support us at. You get lots of extras, exclusive content, but most importantly, you'll be helping me to keep pushing for the changes that we want to see. You'll be helping us bring the voices that you hear in this podcast to the public, into the debate. These voices are so important in bringing about change. So please head to patreon.com/tortoiseshack and show your support. We thank you. We really appreciate it and enjoy the rest of the podcast.
To be fair, I thought it was quite interesting at the National Economic Dialogue that there was this openness in talking about budgets and finances to at least talk about social infrastructure in the same vein, you know, to talk about the fact that we needed a well-being budget. There was some emphasis put on certainly the breakout room that I was in with Minister Michael McGrath around, you know, looking at those well-being indicators that were published at the end of last year when the budget came out, and the fact that NESC have been doing some work around the framework, and I was on the group for that as well, and the fact that the Taoiseach's office has taken the lead and DEEPER are doing some work in relation to the actual indicators, and the CSO were putting together their well-being dashboards. So there was definitely an acceptance that more has to be done in terms of the social infrastructure, that, you know, when we do put our economy back together, that it should be an economy that's underpinning what we actually need as a society. Of course, that, you know, that definition of what we need as a society is the thing that's up for grabs. So, you know, we would certainly be looking at an economy that sustains things like public housing, social housing, really properly affordable housing, sustainable childcare, and subsidized childcare, you know, education system that deals with educational disadvantage. I was really surprised to hear from one of the contributors in relation to children with intellectual disabilities that aren't getting career guidance. So when you think about the poverty rate among people living with disabilities, you're not even getting career guidance to establish the fact that you have the capacity to actually have a career. What message is that sending?
Yeah.
You know, so we need to look at that in the round. Obviously, we need to start thinking about, you know, regeneration in terms of rural regeneration. We also need to look at, you know, things like urban regeneration. We need to look at things like broadband. You know, there's a huge amount there that when we talk about what we need an economy to underpin in terms of well-being, we need to agree on what that well-being vision actually is. Now, as I say, my sense of it was that there was an understanding, at least, that that's what needed to be done. Now, whether that will play out is another thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's very interesting, I think, in terms of particularly that idea of well-being and how we reorientate our economies, as you say, to suit the needs or to meet the needs of society, and developing those. I know in the past there was talks of equality budgeting, and but these well-being indicators are obviously something that have developed that further now, and it is very important to look at that and measure society not just through those crude GDP measures, but actually how are we doing as society on those indicators. So that's very important to watch and see where that goes. Ciarán, what's your kind of sense of where things are at economically, the government's approach? And
I agree with your analysis there that there was a contradiction with, you know, at the same time, some acknowledgement of the kind of challenges ahead in terms of needing resources to pay for maybe climate, a just transition to a low carbon economy, etc., and a couple of other things like that. But at the same time, this contradiction with the austerity talk coming back in again, and, you know, it's not in my session, at least, although some of the rapporteurs, again, and there was an interesting contradiction there at the end where Pascal O'Donoghue took issue with one of the rapporteurs' reports, where he said nobody was looking for cutting taxes, and Pascal kind of, well, that's not what I heard. And so, and our, you know, that whole paradigm in terms of, you know, how are we going to pay these debts off, the way we service our debts and our interest rates and stuff like that are in relation to, you know, other countries. So everybody has gone through the same thing. Those issues don't apply really like they would have in the past. If everybody's interest rates are going up, everybody's interest rates are going up, and the capital will come into governments for borrowing, you know, based on that. So those issues don't really apply. But at the same time, I'm not with some acknowledgement that we need to pay for these things. Nobody was really saying, look, we need to, you know, increase employers' PRSI or bring in net wealth taxes or whatever else. Tom McDonald, the director in the NRI, has done a lot of work on areas where we can, you know, increase revenue up to standards that, you know, high income EU countries with the amount of revenue they collect. Whereas we have a shortfall of about, I think it's in and around 10-11 billion if we just came up to averages in what we would consider our you know, comparator countries in an EU context. So that kind of, you know, doesn't bode well. There was a lot of talk in my session again about competitiveness and in an Irish context that usually means wages, and that's different. You know, wage competitiveness is not really something that high income European countries are concerned about. Actually, the most competitive countries in the world, when you look at these indices, are high wage countries. So they improve their competitiveness by, you know, better investment in education, in research and development, in infrastructure like broadband at home, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, it is a fact that we will need to raise revenue somehow, somewhere, if we want to do those things. And, you know, a lot of my work is about young people and labour markets for young people and precarious work and wages, et cetera. And the government could, you know, there's a role for the state, as happens in other high income EU countries that we don't do here, to kind of push better decent work going forward and learn from the experience of the last crisis, where, you know, austerity was brought in and borne by younger generations and new entrants. So I'm not, as you said, like this time last year, I think we were talking about a paradigm shift, and that's all over the place. And Rory, you'll know, if the SRI are calling for whatever it is, double, triple investment in housing, then that applies to a just transition as well. That applies to childcare as well. Any of these things that we really want to develop going forward to underpin, you know, a healthy labour market, a healthy economy, which, you know, provides decent work and underpins decent standards of living. Yeah, we're gonna have to do those things. And I don't feel, especially, you know, Leo Varadkar was out. I don't know if he was just kite flying about cutting the top marginal tax rate there last week or the week before. But the, you know, this is the mind frame of the leaders of the country, and it doesn't bode well. But I think electorally, you know, it's just going, they're shooting themselves in the foot, I think, with this stuff going forward. And we can see that change in the electoral landscape, which is really being pushed by younger voters.
I think that there's a lot there. Sorry, Colette, I was just going to say before I bring you back in that this idea of a paradigm shift, it seems to have escaped the Irish government, that, like, what's going on? Like, I was actually quite taken aback by Pascal's message, where he said, you know, the focus was on the whatever number of trillion, you know, the country is in debt. And I read, you know, some of the, what we're talking about now, the Summer Economic Report and what the Department of Finance are saying. And I think irrespective of the revenue tax side of things, the idea that basically they're saying we're not going to increase borrowing, we're not going to take on the ESRI's recommendations that actually it's financially prudent to borrow, that actually they're going back into we have to cut the debt back.
Yeah, there was an interesting piece yesterday, the day before, with the opening statement. And I don't know, I can't remember now if it was the Taoiseach or if it was the Minister for Finance that mentioned it, but it was in relation to, you know, how we're going to fund all the things that we need to do. And there was this talk about, or this mentioning at least, of broadening the tax base, and we need to broaden the tax base. And then absolutely no detail of what that might actually look like. And you're right. I mean, there was a lot of talk about competitiveness, and FDI got a great hearing. But again, when you look at the SME sector, the indigenous SME sector, that's the thing that needs to be protected and preserved. And that needs to be brought into that whole just transition landscape. Because that's where your employment, your long-term sustainable employment is going to come from. And I think, you know, even when we talk about the corporation taxes and the things that are going on currently, like, to a man other than government, you know, it's not about, like, FDI is not just about the tax rate. It's about the fact that we have a highly educated workforce that speaks English, that's close to the European economy. So, you know, those narratives that were coming out, those messages that were coming out pre-pandemic, are absolutely falling hollow at this point. And it really does need, and I think my point about the well-being budgeting and the well-being frameworks and all of that stuff being very good, you know, it is very good, but it has to be underpinned by this transformational change. Because if everybody just looks at it and says, that's a really good set of indicators, don't they look lovely? The CSO will do a great dashboard now on that with a whole load of colour. But business as usual in government departments and civil services, no, you know, cross-departmental approaches to anything, no analysis on, you know, societal analysis on how they're going to be implemented, then there's no point. So there needs to be, you know, that programme alongside the wellbeing framework. So to actually, how are you going to implement it? How are you going to implement it from the top down and bottom up? Everybody needs to kind of get to grips with it. Otherwise, it'll be absolutely useless.
Yeah, and it seems that the tax cut, like if we take the tax cutting agenda idea again floated, as you said, you know, whichever of them mentioned, you know, we need to broaden the tax base, which is completely contradictory to cutting taxes of, and particularly cutting taxes at the high end. And it seems that I think that, again, you know, to take up Ciarán's point, that they're actually running contrary to the public opinion on this. We saw the opinion poll in the Sunday Business Post, which it builds on opinion polls over the last couple of years. The Irish Times and others have run every opinion poll, I think, done in relation to the budget, for example, over the last 3 or 4 years, has consistently shown the public, when asked, do you want to prioritise investment in public services or tax cuts? They will say investment in public services. Because the one thing we have learned from the crash was we need a bloody health service. We need a housing. We need public services. And I think it seems to be, the question is, yeah, why are they still pushing it when actually the majority of the public wants something different now?
I ask myself the same question all the time. And I only come to one conclusion, that is, you know, you look at these political science kind of models for trying to predict the behavior of politicians, and the only one that kind of fits in there is just the ideological one, and that they're true believers in what they're doing, and that they won't be talked around. Although, again, rhetorically, you've heard the likes of Leo Varadkar and Pascal Dunne, who changed their tune slightly over the last year at times. Then again, maybe wrong.
Yeah.
But that, I mean,
even great to hear Leo Varadkar believing that housing is a human right.
Yeah, you know, like, this is it. So, yeah, you have to, it's nice to hear that, but we'll have to see some, but again, as you said, there's the resistance, that's the great point as well. We've had, you know, months and months of our lives, maybe not unnecessarily taken away, but like, we have had a long lockdown, and that is connected, as you said, to the fact that if our ICU departments around the country, you know, were met with X amount of cases of COVID, they'd clearly break down, and it would look absolutely terrible. And that's from years of underinvestment, and again, a low tax take to support a universal health system. And I don't know why they do it. And the polling keeps, I mean, there's no, the strategy seems, the strategy's not working. I won't go into that, but it does fascinate me as the, because see, in 2015 it was the same, and it was the same in the last one, and the two biggest parties kept losing votes over and over again. You know, in 2015 it was like, let's keep the recovery going or whatever, and I just come out of college at that time as a mature student and whatever, sent away 60 CVs without a response, and it was kind of like, who are you talking to there? And and then the age demographic thing comes into that, and who really suffered.
It seems to be that they're willing to accept a certain social price of their policies to be continued, and in particular that you know, your generation, you know, 250,000 young people emigrated between 2010 and 2015, and that was accepted. Yeah, that's the cost of the austerity adjustment. And it does raise that question of, you know, it's not that they know the impacts of what they're doing, they're, you know, suiting certain people. That, and this is what you talked about, maybe you could just talk briefly here on before I go back to Colette, is the work you've been doing on showing the inequality, that, and particularly generational inequality.
Yeah.
Speak up. What is it?
Amy offered us ice cream.
That's fine. You go have some ice cream. And the interjection from Aisling, my daughter, can I have ice cream or not? Of course you can have ice cream. So I can continue the podcast. It's her first ice cream today, of course. Virtue signaling parenting.
Mine are being parented by the Nintendo Switch, so I can't comment whatsoever.
I know it's summer, the schools are finished. Who knows what at what point we might get an intervention. In terms of where's my head gone to, very far away. Kieran, what was I saying?
You were saying about inequality, generational inequality.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah, generational inequality, that we're seeing this generational and social, but particularly generational inequalities, along with obviously gaps, that is resulting from these kind of policies. And in, you know, that there's this kind of, there's an acceptance certain groups, you know, will pay the price, but yet claiming, oh, we're one of the most equal countries in the world. What is your research showing? You've done some research on that recently and highlighted.
Yeah, there was some 2018 data that came out at the end of last year, which is, you know, our available data on wages and earnings, especially in terms of, you know, a time series, long time series, is not great. So this new stuff came out, which you can compare to 30 other countries, basically. And it's got a good level of detail in terms of age groups and, you know, occupational groups, gender, like business economy, full-time, part-time, all this kind of stuff. And basically what it showed is what I think everybody under 40 or, you know, and most people over 40 understand is what has happened over the last decade or more, is that, and especially for maybe older millennials who had experience of the labour market pre-2008, such as myself, is that, you know, the wages have not kept up, or, you know, it relative to average wages in the economy, there has been a concerted effort, and you know, advertised as such, you know, internal devaluation, you know, once the Troika came in 2010, it was about keeping a lid on wages, and that was a good thing. But at the same time, coming out and saying there's no evidence that, you know, young people, the labour market is more precarious or less well paid for young people. So there's a contradiction there, I thought, in messaging. And then they just didn't seem to be the research that would just show, yeah, look, this is what wages look like for graduates between the ages of 25 and 35 over the years or whatever. But there's good data on that now, and it shows what we all know, like, to be the case, I think, or everybody I know knows to be the case. And it's that average wages, whether it's full-time, whether it's, you know, in these different occupations like managers or professionals or craft workers, trade workers, clerical workers, wherever, whichever way you measure it, average wages for younger workers have fallen relative to the rest over the last, whatever it is, 12, 13 years. And so, yeah, that report came out last week. And in a European context, in a high income European context, we are, you know, an outlier in terms of the gap between the top and the bottom in wages. Now, we've, you know, there's a lot that you mentioned inequality there, and the framing in the kind of inequality debate is quite narrow, and it often is based on household income, which I don't think is necessary. Like, I mean, we can measure it, and but we should compare it to wages. Wages, you know, in housing affordability, say wages are what's important. Like, how many hours work do I have to do to cover the rent and stuff like that? So household income, there's a growing share of adult children living at home. So if they're working but can't afford to move out, then they're, you know, their income is counted in the household. So there's compositional issues there that mask the real issue, which obviously from a trade union think tank such as the NERI, the real important indicator is wages, you know, hourly, monthly, annual wages, and what they can get you in terms of goods and services and a standard of living. So all of those things have fallen and are low in a high European context, and even in a European context. I mean, I did one indicator there which shows the gap between the top and the bottom, and I use 11 high income European countries, but there's actually 30 in the sample. And when you look at it, Ireland, you know, there's only one country out of 30 that really sticks out as more unequal than Ireland. That's Cyprus. And I'm pretty sure they're kind of a pretty bad tax haven or whatever. Maybe I'll get in trouble for if it's not, you know, definitionally true for some people. But even then, we're fifth or sixth out of 30. And those other four or five are the likes of Bulgaria, Romania, Poland, people we don't really identify as with, I think, in the Irish, you know, in the Irish psyche. And they're all very similar in the gap between the bottom and the top.
And Ciarán, just the big argument that's thrown against that is that, okay, that's their market, you know, the wages people get from the market, and that when the social welfare system and transfers come in, taxation that, you know, we come out much more closer and much more equal in terms of.
Well, that's true, but we have to. And that kind of, you know, we've got a very, you know, when we look at social welfare, it's almost charity in an Irish, we look at it as charity in an Irish context. And a lot of these low income workers still have to be, their living standards have to be subsidized by the state. One interesting statistic that came up there recently with all these, you know, household disposable incomes and all that kind of stuff, you can see the composition of income and the composition of spending by the state in terms of social transfers. And in a period between 2012 and 2019, when 500,000 people more were at work, the you know, the spending on unemployment obviously fell dramatically, right?
Yeah.
But the spending on housing didn't, and it's actually up slightly on 2012 per average household. So, you know, yeah, yes, the state has to do heavy lifting to bring about more equal outcomes, but I mean, they wouldn't have to do that. They wouldn't have to intervene if we had, you know, a living wage, say, for instance, or if we enacted better legislation for collective bargaining and to recognise the rights of unions, etc. So, and Tom McDonald makes that point in a recent paper, and it's, there's a link to it in that most recent blog. So yeah, I mean, it's true. Then we have average outcomes after that, but I mean, the state wouldn't have to do as much lifting, and there wouldn't be as much burden on revenue if we enacted policies to tackle that.
Yeah, and of course, there's problems as well in terms of that, even, you know, around and Richard Wilkinson talks about the whole, you know, the social and psychosocial impacts of inequalities in terms of wages and supports and issues around that. Thanks for that, Ciarán. Colette, what's your kind of sense analysis of, you know, where we're at now in Ireland in terms of inequality and what Ciarán's, you know, highlighted there?
Yeah, I think you had a very interesting point there, Rory, when you were introducing that question in terms of, you know, are we prepared to accept kind of a certain societal fallout? And I think you're right. And I think, you know, we had that leverage of, or that lever of youth migration back in 2008. We had
safety valve.
We had the, you know, that's not available now. And I think there's almost safety in numbers, if I can be that kind of crass about it, that there are so many young people experiencing work disruption or unemployment now that it's almost a, well, what can you do when it's just this big? Rather than actually looking at it as an issue that needs to be tackled. It almost gives political coverage because it's just so great an issue. Yeah. And I think it is interesting in terms of, you know, when we did our employment monitor back in May, we looked at, you know, we did a deep dive onto the data set that the CSO had published in relation to the labour force survey that was done at the end of last year, where it talked about 21% of all employees whose employment had been affected by COVID. So that's, you know, people who were on PUP or had been on PUP, people who were being supplemented by the EWSS, and others whose employment had been impacted but who couldn't access those payments. So it's a fairly broad, I think it's about 1.2 million workers. And the vast majority of those, that 21% who said they didn't expect to go back to the same job post-COVID, were younger workers. They were a younger workforce. But within that, there's also proportionately an older workforce who are going to be deeply impacted. Because while you can put in place apprenticeships and jobs activation and retraining and upskilling and all of those things that you can try to kind of band-aid the youth unemployment crisis with, there's very little emphasis on those workers who are 60 plus, who are also experiencing that, who are looking at their years pre-retirement in unemployment, and who will find it very, very difficult to upskill or retrain if those programs aren't aimed at them. And they tend not to be targeted in that way. I think in terms of another kind of interesting piece, when we look at what we've needed in the pandemic and what, again, the sectors that expect to lose employees, the employees who expect to lose their jobs, you know, the information technology sector is going to take a hit. Now, fair enough, that got ramped up in terms of everybody using Zoom and Teams and all of the different packages that you have while we were working from home. But, you know, we still need an information technology sector. We still need to grow that. We still need to provide jobs in those areas. And yet 44,000 employees don't expect to go back to a job. Similarly, in healthcare, you can't say that pre-pandemic we had a functioning healthcare system, and yet 31,000 employees didn't expect to return to the same job. We had that community call, we had that kind of health service call, we brought people over from across the globe, you know, and whether or not we actually happened to deploy them is another matter. But if you've got 31,000 people that don't expect to go back to the same job, and we still don't have a primary healthcare network, we still don't, you know, we've got waiting lists of 18 months plus. We need to do something with all of that that would have a real impact on addressing the inequalities, because these are industries that have an infrastructural impact as well. And that if they're developed in terms of, you know, so we looked at construction as well. But I mean, there's capacity there to build local and regional economies. Stop talking about the kind of broader stuff and look at what you actually need to do at a much smaller level that can actually have a bigger impact collectively.
Yeah. No, I, again, you know, there's a lot there, and it's it's kind of hard to focus this discussion within a short space of time, but I know I want to come back to it again. We're, you know, kind of almost, I know we're in the summer season, but in a way, obviously, a part of the economic dialogue, it's the run up to the budget in October as well. And there's going to be some pretty big decisions, I think, and a lot of focus in particular on housing, and that question of will we see the recommendation from the ESRI to increase up to 4 billion, which they should do clearly. Will we see that increase in borrowing in the government and allocation? What do you think, Colette?
Yeah, I mean, we put out our 10-point plan on housing when we made our submission, and we looked for 3.3 billion on the build side, so a capital investment of 3.3, and that would provide.
It's currently 1 billion about.
Yeah. So we were looking to triple that.
The same amount that goes to the landlords, private landlords, and subsidies.
Yes. So we were looking, as I say, to increase that, to move away from the social housing solutions, which is a complete misnomer, but also then to look at doing something on the mortgage arrears side, because yes, we absolutely need to do something around construction, and everybody knows we need to do that build. We need to definitely increase the investment around that, particularly when it comes to social housing. I think the economic recovery plan had a build target of 33,000 per annum, which is just enough to sit still. It doesn't actually address the deficits of the last decade and a half. But on top of that, when you look at the mortgage arrears and you look at the tapering down of PUP and you look at the amount of people who are going to be out of work, we've got a real issue that needs to be addressed in terms of the current mortgage arrears crisis and the future one that's coming at us. So just looking at the data today, actually, because we're getting ready for our budget choices launch on Monday, shameless plug. But looking at it, those mortgages that are in arrears, there's 1.4 billion in mortgage debt are in arrears of more than 10 years. And of that 1.4 million that's outstanding, more than half of it is actually arrears. That's a huge amount of debt to be carrying for that extent of time. And when we talk about well-being, you can't possibly, like I worked in the debt space and the policy side of debt support for almost a decade. You've got people who have committed suicide because of debts. You've got people whose families have broken apart because of debts. You've got people who lost their job, lost all of their self-esteem, and just had a serious and severe mental and physical health crisis because of debt. And nothing has really substantively been done to address it. The policies that have been put in place are sticking plasters. The CCMA got stripped in 2013. The Code of Conduct on Mortgage Arrears got absolutely stripped in 2013 in terms of the good it could have done. The previous version of it was an awful lot better. The insolvency supports are not fit for purpose. They disproportionately benefit those with greater resources to be able to pay the kind of higher end pips who can actually work the numbers to their favor. All very legal. Yeah. I'm trying not to get into trouble, but it's definitely, you know, when I worked on the debt relief notice side, and there's very little capacity on that side at all, both in terms of policy, but in terms of the insolvency service supports. The Awalia program, to me, it's a subsidy for personal insolvency practitioners who would have lost their jobs otherwise. So it's not actually aimed at the people who need it. It's aimed at the industry. It's this industry of misery that was created. And that has not had the impact that you would want from mortgage arrears policies following on from a crisis that started in 2007, 2008. And if we're now looking at facing another one, we have to do something about it that actually underpins it now.
Yeah. No, I think you're right to put the focus on that. And I think I know that, again, it's that idea, you know, that I was saying that kind of acceptance of the social, you know, costs. And of course, the people who bear it are the most vulnerable, the most isolated in terms of that, you know, the massive, you know, mental health, the toll, as you say, the family tolls of carrying that debt for that length of time, that lack of knowing the future, the stress. It's just incredible that, you know, what we allow being done be done to people. But no, I appreciate that, Colette. Ciarán, last words to you then, in terms of, you know, the budget. Do you think that my sense is that they're going to be under a lot of pressure to significantly increase the capital expenditure in housing, you know, to implement the ESRI recommendations of adding at least 2 to 3 billion on top of the home building currently?
Well, I hope so, and I think that's what your podcast is about and your book as well. I certainly hope so. They'll resist it. You know, I actually can't imagine them, you know, completely falling to it, to be honest. Like, I'm looking at all the same. You know, again, we this time last year it looked like a paradigm shift. This time, it doesn't. And you're seeing all the same mistakes basically being made in all sorts of areas in terms of how we're going to, you know, plug the, and that's the main framework that they use, is to plug the public finances. So we're back to, you know, Rory, the first time I met you was talking about Job Bridge and the We're Not Leaving campaign years and years ago. So they're back to active labour market policies already. They're talking, all the conversation I was in yesterday about the future of jobs, you know, it didn't really recognize the fact that the labor market hadn't really, you know, bounced back from 2008, and we're going to be back to, you know, upskilling, but there's nothing on the demand side. There's no, oh, let's, you know, create a bunch of public sector jobs for retrofitting, let's spend money here and there and increase the size of the state. So I think there's, you know, a real belief system there in the way. And even with the ESRI, I mean, you know, the ESRI aren't really known for being that controversial or you know, you don't see public, not very often, you don't see disagreements there or big ones. And usually they'll, you know, they came out and criticised that, didn't they? And so I don't think we'll see the 3 billion. I hope they do, and I think everybody should continue to pressure the Irish government to make an announcement like that. But that would also involve decisions that it seems government doesn't want to make on increasing revenue collection. There was also, you know, I thought an assumption that the fiscal rules would come back sooner rather than later. I'm not too sure how sure we can be about that, considering, you know, even the IMF are on side now. G7 are looking at, you know, minimum corporate tax rates, etc. So I think, like, yeah, I'm not sure that'll happen, but I'm not positive. I'm not confident that 3 billion will be raised and spent on building houses. I think there's an issue there around the capacity we've lost as well for government to actually enter the market and build houses. But
they can build that capacity if they want to.
Yes, absolutely. And that's probably why that amount of money is needed. And they absolutely should. And yeah, hopefully they do. But I don't know. Fingers crossed anyway, Rory.
Well, listen, we'll do more than fingers crossed. We keep banging on about it.
That's it.
And we'll keep pointing out what's possible and what should be done, because we cannot allow the situation continue in terms of inequality and the housing crisis. So Ciarán Nugent from The Economist with the Nevin Economic Research Institute, and Colette Bennett, Economic and Social Policy Analyst with Social Justice Ireland. Thanks a million for joining me today on Reboot Republic.
Thanks a million.
Thank you very much.
And we'll talk to you hopefully soon in terms of the run-up to the budget and do more analysis about what should be done on that. And to our listeners, yeah, we'll continue on this discussion. And remember, you can listen back to previous episodes covering lots of issues which cover housing, inequality, poverty. You can listen back, enjoy them. And thanks a million for listening. And we'll talk to you all soon.